Chapter 7. Rachel. The Oil Gazing. It was the little minx Dinah who was thus conceived, an ill-fated child. But through her, Leah's womb was opened anew. After a pause of 4 years, the sturdy creature came again into action. In the 10th year of wedlock, she bore Issachar, the bony ass. In the 11th, Zebulun, who would not be a shepherd. Poor Rachel. She had the dudaim, and Leah bore the fruit. God would have it so, and for yet a while, until his will changed, or rather reached a new stage, until a further segment of his scheme became plain in time, and Jacob, the man of the blessing, was vouchsafed a joy fuller of life and more pregnant with suffering than his time-imprisoned human sense gave him to understand when he received it. Laban, the clod, had very likely been right when he said, in his sluggishness over the beer, that blessing was strength, and life strength, and nothing else. For it is vain superstition to think that the life of men of blessing is nothing but happiness and shallow well-being, for the blessing is, in truth, only the basis of their existence, gleaming goldenly through a plenitude of affliction and trial. In the 12th year of marriage, the 19th of Jacob's sojourn, no child was born, but in the 13th and 20th, Rachel became expectant. What a turn that was! What a new beginning! We may fancy the anxious, incredulous rejoicing and Jacob's weak-kneed exultation. She was then 31 years old. No one still thought that God meant thus at last to smile upon her. In Jacob's eyes, she was Sarah, to whom the threefold man announced a son against all the laws of probability. He called her by the name of that early mother as he sat at her feet and gazed through adoring tears into her pale and twitching face, which to him seemed lovelier than ever. But their fruit, the long-withheld, at length conceived, the child which had by inscrutable providence so many years been denied to their hopeful longings, it, he called, while she was still carrying it, by the primitive, archaic name of a youthful god, scarcely any longer officially recognized, though beloved among the people, Dumuzi, the true son. Leah heard it. She had borne him 6 true sons and an equally true daughter. But she had understood without that. Quite plainly and openly she told her 4 eldest sons, at that time from 10 to 13 years old, as good as grown, sturdy, competent, manly youths, withal rather ill-favored, and all of them with a tendency to inflamed eyelids, "Sons of Jacob and Leah, we are undone. If she bear him a son, and as the gods see my heart, I wish her joy and health, then the master will look no more at us, neither you nor the little ones, nor the children of the maids, and me least of all, were I 10 times the first wife. For that I am, and 7-fold have his God and my father's gods blessed me with motherhood. But she is the favorite. Therefore is she likewise the first and the only one, so proud is his feeling. And he calleth her son, who hath not yet seen the light, Dumuzi. Ye have heard it? Dumuzi. It is like a knife in my breast, and a blow in my face, and like a wheel it is in the face of each of you. Yet must we endure it, for so it is, my sons. We must be strong, I and ye, and hold our hearts in both our hands, that they burst not against the injustice. We must love and honor our master, though we were in future worthless in his eye, and he will look through us as though we were air. And her too I will love, and will enforce my heart, that it may not curse her, for it is tender toward the little sister, and mindful of our childhood days. But with violence it longeth to curse the favorite, her who shall bear Dumuzi. And so divided are my feelings for her, that I am ill and sick of it in my very body, and no longer know myself. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah caressed her awkwardly. Her red eyes were brooding, and she gnawed her underlip. It was then it began, then that stirred in Reuben's heart the beginning of that sudden angry deed which he was to commit for Leah's sake. and which would be the beginning of the end of his firstborn rights. Then that was planted in the brothers' breasts that seed of hatred against the life which was as yet only a seed, the sowing begun of a harvest of unnameable anguish for Jacob, the man of the blessing. Did it then have to be so? Could not peace and blithe good feeling have reigned among the tribe of Jacob, and events have taken a mild and even course of mutual toleration? Alas, no, if that which happened had to happen, and if the fact that it happened is evidence that it must and was to happen. Very much happens in the world, and as we cannot wish that it might rather have peacefully remained unhappened, we may not curse the passions which are its instrument, for without passion and guilt nothing could proceed. The great notice that was taken of Rachel's condition was in itself monstrous to Leah and a vexation to her spirit, her own healthy pregnancies having passed with no attention from anyone. But Rachel, through hers, became, as it were, consecrated, a conception of which, of course, Jacob was the author, but which infected everybody in the house, from Laban down to the meanest of the stable hands. They all moved about her on tiptoe, and spoke to her only in soft, commiserating voices, with head inclined and hands describing curves, as though to caress the air about her person. All that lacked was the strewing of palm branches and the laying of carpets, that her foot might not strike against a stone. Palely smiling, she accepted all the adulation, less out of self-love than for the sake of the fruit of Jacob, with which she had at last been blessed, and in honor of Dumuzi, the genuine son. But who can tell the difference between meekness and arrogance in one endowed with the blessing? Behung with amulets, she sat, forbidden to lift hand in house or court, garden or field. Jacob forbade it. He wept if she did not eat, or could not keep down what she had eaten, for she sickened from week to week, and it was greatly feared that she was afflicted by some evil spirit of the air. Adina, her mother, plied her with bandages and application of ointments made after some old recipe, whose effect should be twofold, naturally emollient and healing, as well as a charm and protection against evil. She ground up nightshade, garden cress, dog's tongue, and the root of the plant of Namtar, lord of the 60 diseases, mixed the powder with pure and expressly consecrated oil, and massaged the expecting one round the navel with an upward motion, muttering as she did so in a meaningless and mumbled jargon, "Bad Utuku, bad Alu, go away, bad death spirit, Labartu, Lamashtu, heart disease, grips, head pains, toothache, Asaku, harmful Namtaru, go away, out of the house, by heaven and earth I conjure you." In the fifth month, Laban insisted that Rachel be taken to a priest seer at the temple of Sin, Ehulhul at Haran, that her future and the child's might be foretold. Jacob held to his principles, giving his voice against it and refusing his cooperation. But that was outwardly. Inwardly, he was as eager as the others to hear the prophecy, and the first to desire that no time should be lost. Moreover, the prophet in question, the old seer and temple incumbent, Rimani Bel, Bel have mercy upon me, a son and grandson of prophets, was a very popular and experienced soothsayer and oil-gazer, who, according to the consensus of opinion, was a master of the art and had a constant stream of visitors. Jacob refused, naturally, to appear before him as a petitioner and sacrifice to the moon, but he was much too curious to hear whatever might be said from any point of view of Rachel's condition, not to give way circumspectly to the parents' wishes. Thus they set forth, Laban and Adina, on the way to Haran, holding on both sides the bridle of the ass upon which the pale and pregnant woman sat. They led it with care that it might not stumble and shake her, and they dragged behind them the sheep for the sacrifice. Jacob waved them goodbye. He stopped at home, not to afflict his eyes with the pompous abominations of Ehulhul, nor vex his spirit with the sight of the house beside it, where live the temple prostitutes and love-boys, whose embraces could be hired for the honor of the idol and the payment of a round sum of money. Thus, without personal contamination, he awaited the verdict of the son of Seers, the prophecy of the gazing, which the others brought back with them. Clearly, it had given them to think. He listened silently to their account of their experience in the temple precincts, and before the face of Rimani Bell, the oil-gazer, or Rimut, as he was called for short. "Just call me Rimut," he had said in his mildness, "for indeed I am called Rimani Bell, that sin may have mercy upon me, but I am myself full of mercy for those who in their need and their doubt learn to sacrifice, and therefore shall ye say simply, Mercy, when ye speak to me. It is shorter, and it suits my looks." And then he asked what needful things they had brought with them, and examined the spotlessness of the offering, and directed them to buy such and such spices for the burnt offering at a booth in the main court. A charming man, this Rimani Bell, or Rimut, in his white linen garments and cone-shaped linen cap, already old, but of lithe figure, not misshapen by corpulence, with a white beard, a bulbous red nose, and twinkling eyes, which made one feel merry when one looked at them. "I am well-shapen," he said, "unblemished without and within, like the sacrificial animal when it is well-favored, and the sheep when there is naught to say against it. I am of the right height and girth, and my leg is crooked neither out nor in, nor have I lost a single tooth, nor am afflicted with disease of the scrotum, nor do I squint. Only my nose is somewhat red, as ye can see, yet out of cheerfulness and mirth, and no other cause, for I am as sober as the purest water. I could come naked before God, as it was once the custom, as we read and are told. Now we stand before him in white linen, and in this too I rejoice, for it is pure and sober likewise, and conformable to my soul. I cherish no envy of my brethren, the exorcising priests, who do their incanting in a red garment with a mantle, enveloped in terrifying splendor, in order to throw into a fright all the demons and lurkers and sprites of the air. They, too, are useful and necessary and worthy of their hire, but Rimani Bell, that is me, would not be one of them, nor one of the priests who do the washing and anointing, nor a possessed, nor yet a wailing priest, not one of those whose manhood Ishtar hath changed into the female, however holy it may be. I bear none of them the least grudge. My own skin fits me too well, nor should I care to practice any other kind of soothsaying than just the oil-gazing, for it is far and away the most sensible, the clearest and the best. Just between ourselves, in the augury from inspection of the liver and the oracle of the arrow, a great deal of arbitrary choice cometh in, and also the interpretation of dreams and transports is not without sources of error, so that often I have privily to smile. But as for you, father and mother and pregnant child, ye have taken the right road and knocked on the right door. For I am descended from Ain Medduranki, who was king of Sippar before the flood, sage and guardian of the art entrusted to him by the great gods, to look upon oil on water, and to recognize, according to the behavior of the oil, what shall come to pass. From him I am descended in a direct line from father to son, and the tradition is unbroken, for always the father made the son whom he loved to swear upon tablet and writing tool of Shamash and Adad, and had him learn the work when the sons of the seers, down to Rimut, the blithe and blameless, and that is me. And I receive of the sheep, that ye may know beforehand, the hinder part, the fell, and a pot of broth. Further, the sinews and the half of the entrails, according to the tables and according to the array. The loins, the right leg, and a goodly roasting piece, the god receiveth, and what is left, we servers of the temple have at the temple meal. Are ye satisfied?